Dove Audio presents The Art and Skill of Conversation by Edward L. Fritsch and Nathan P. Rosenblatt, read by the authors.
It takes only a slight edge to be the person who's in front of the pack. In baseball, for instance, the 200 hitter is a minor leaguer, and the 300 hitter makes the big bucks in the major leagues. And the only thing that separates them is one little hit out of every 10 tries. In many cases, and some would argue in most cases, the difference doesn't really have anything to do with talent. The key is in technique. Some 200 hitters could be better, but they just won't exercise bat control. They won't cut down on their swings or choke up on their bats. They just won't do the right thing at the right time in the right way. And you can say the same about some of our conversations that go wrong. Let's listen.
Shall we do it at your place or mine?
Don't get cute with me, George.
What are you talking about?
Your place or mine? That's insulting and sexist.
Hey, come on. All I meant was, do you want to have the budget meeting in your office or mine?
Well, why don't you just say what you mean in the first place and think about what you're saying?
We've all been misunderstood, misled, misquoted, and misinterpreted in our business and personal lives. And many of these types of miscommunication represent lost opportunities, damaged relationships, discarding of good ideas, or results that you never intended to happen. What this course is going to do is develop your innate ability to become an expert communicator who can get an idea across to a boss, subordinate, friend or colleague, business or social acquaintance, a perfect stranger or prospective client, even members of your own family. I make my living by communicating, and I know that the techniques disclosed here will work magic for you. I can tell you from experience that virtually anyone who wants to can not only improve, but can become the someone who everybody else wants to talk to. As you progress through this remarkably effective program, you'll see for yourself that by following a few simple principles, you can hold your own in any situation. I've seen the light bulb switch on with engineers who thought good morning was a speech. I've seen managers get more productivity from employees. Husbands and wives communicate better. People from every walk of life perform better at everything they do. You can, too, if you listen carefully to these tapes and do your workbook exercises. Here's what's ahead for you as you learn the art and skill of conversation. Number one, you'll learn that one of the great conversational skills is listening. Inevitably, good listeners are considered terrific conversationalists. Many people equate silence with listening, but nothing could be further from the truth. Listening requires thinking, body language, and feelings. Silence is nothing more than keeping your mouth shut. I'm telling you in advance that if you do nothing more than learn to listen actively, people will start to comment on what a terrific conversationalist you are. And I can't wait for you to find out for yourself. Number two, you'll learn how to use questions to keep conversations flowing. Questions show others that you care about what they're saying, and they help make it easy for others to respond to you. Not surprisingly, the best questioners are the best listeners because they pick up conversational clues that most people miss. Number three, you'll acquire surefire methods for persuasion, motivation, negotiation, and building solid relationships. By learning how to apply six critical steps that make communication and conversation pay off big for you in your personal and business life. You'll also be given some quick starts, proven conversational starters that can make you the hit of any gathering, social, or business. In fact, because these quick starts are so much fun, let's go out of sequence and do one right now. This first quick start works because most people love to talk. And what they most love to talk about is themselves. It also works because we're all different and bring all sorts of viewpoints to a discussion. Okay, here it is. It's a version of the old what-if game. Remember as a child, what if I had $1 million or what if I could fly like Superman? Rather than tell you what the first quick start is, I'll let you figure it out for yourself. Let's listen as Jane works this quick start in. She's with a group of people she really wants to impress. Jane is listening to Sue and Jack talk waiting for just the right moment. Let's see how she does.
That's a great idea.
I thought so, too. If we just take about a quarter inch off the edge, we can probably save thousands of dollars in paper.
And that's not all. That quarter inch difference lets us go to a smaller press, so the printing won't cost as much either.
This is great. Any other ideas while we're on a roll? How about you, Jane?
If there were only four ways to make a living, which would you choose? Would you be an entertainer, a social worker, an administrator, or a scientist?
What did you say?
If there were only four ways to make a living, Jack, shouldn't we say hello to Douglas and Mary? Excuse us, Jane.
I think I'll join you. Come on, Fran. I haven't seen Doug in months.
So much for taking things out of sequence. Jane missed the most important part of joining in the conversation. She was so busy concentrating on what she wanted to say, in this case her quick start, that she didn't listen to what was going on. Whether she meant to or not, Jane showed that she wasn't concerned about what anyone else was saying, and she was repaid in kind. This is my way of suggesting strongly that you follow this program in sequence to get the most out of it. Don't jump around, no matter how much you may want to peek ahead. Keep Jane's quick start in mind. We'll come back to it later and show you how well it works when used properly. But first, let's see how well you listen. Did that get your attention? It sure got mine, and I instantly became more alert. Some sounds get our immediate attention, while others are screened out. We hear a baby cry, a scream, a cry for help, the boss telling us there'll be a layoff in 30 days. We listen better to some sounds than to others. But we can train ourselves to listen to everything, and when we do, we'll be better conversationalists. We'll be better leaders. In his book, Thriving on Chaos, Tom Peters has this to say about listening. Become a compulsive listener. Today's successful leaders will work diligently to engage others in their cause. Oddly enough, the best way by far to engage others is by listening, seriously listening to them. If talking and giving orders was the administrative model of the last 50 years, listening to lots of people near the action is the model of the 80s and beyond. You'll hear me say this a lot. Good listening habits are critical to your conversational success. Listen for a moment to this manager offering some ideas about conducting workshops.
Ann, John, you two will be conducting the next workshop. I think it's March 18th on our corporate disability benefits. Since we expect the participants to complete a few exercises, it's important that you establish a good learning climate for them. They have to take your message back to their departments and be able to answer any questions about the benefits. The first few minutes of any workshop are really important, so we'll need to make the introductory comments interesting and relevant, and no more than 7 minutes. And since there are 53 people in the workshop, one of you, whoever's not presenting, should be checking the body language of the group. You'll be able to tell if they're with you or not. I want each participant to be personally greeted by you. People react well to a handshake and a smile. Be sure the room is comfortable and everyone knows where the various facilities are. Be sure you announce the times for break and lunch. I have to warn you, a lot of the people who will be attending don't want to be here. In fact, I heard the marketing department almost had hand-to-hand combat over which supervisor had to attend. Look, it's 10:30, and I have to meet with Ted Koch on our fiscal year budget. John, Ann, we need to meet again to review our objectives for the meeting. Can you both meet me here at, say, 2 p.m. this afternoon?
That was a fairly typical set of instructions. Did you manage to listen to them? Let's see what you remember. What are the names of the people who will be conducting the workshop? What is the subject matter of the workshop? What are the workshop participants expected to do when they return to their departments? How many people will be in the workshop? What do people react well to according to the speaker? How long will the introduction be? Which department had a fight over who had to attend? Who was the speaker leaving to meet? How did you do? If you're like many people, you missed a few completely. If you're like most, you may have missed as many as half of the 8 questions. If you had them all right, you have the ability to become an outstanding conversationalist quickly. In fact, anyone can become a good conversationalist who's willing to learn to listen. The difference between taking this program and just reading a book about conversation is that you're going to get a chance to practice the skill with these tapes. And then you'll hear, not read, but hear, examples of how good listening not only builds conversation, but lets you pick up things that most people miss. Most people say they don't remember things, they have a poor memory, names escape them, and so on. The truth is they simply don't concentrate on their listening. Ideally, you should have a pen and paper on hand when listening to anyone, but that's not always realistic. So the key is to develop the mental discipline of concentrated listening. During your initial practice, focus only on facts. When you can remember things like names and places, you can then practice concentrating on thoughts and ideas. Here's a short practice exercise. This time I warned you, so concentrate. Focus on the information.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 18. I'm Amy Scott. It's 47 degrees, and we're under partly cloudy skies here on Robertson Mall. In the news at this hour, the district attorney's office will ask a family court judge to reconsider dropping charges against 2 12-year-old youths accused of shooting at trucks on Interstate 86. A man from northern Pennsylvania has been accused of attempting to purchase automatic weapons for illegal sale abroad. A South Pittsburgh woman is being held on bail for the attempted kidnap of an 8-month-old baby. And in the continuing trial of 4 men who ran a burglary ring in the Clifton Hills section of the city, the defense will resume cross-examination of the prosecution's key witness.
That's a lot of information in just about 40 seconds. Let's see what you can recall after concentrated listening. What day of the week is it? What is the announcer's name? What is the temperature? What is the first news story about? How about the second? How about the third? If you don't remember anything, try again. But before you listen again, keep these key words in mind. Day, announcer, temperature, first, second, third stories. Rewind the tape and try it again right now. How did you do? Did you remember Amy Scott's name, or that it's the 18th of March, and that the temperature is 47 degrees? What about the 3 stories? Try to repeat this exercise by listening to a television or radio newscast for a minute, or listen to an ad, and see how much you can recall. Just remember, it takes lots of concentration and practice to become good at it. First, listen for facts. Then go for the broader concepts. Norbert Wiener, author of the book The Human Use of Human Beings, describes communication this way. Speech is a joint game between the talker and the listener against the forces of confusion. Unless both make the effort, interpersonal communication is quite hopeless. Now, keep that quote in mind as you listen to this conversation between Ron, a job applicant, and Mr. Watson, the prospective employer.
Mr. Watson, I really appreciate the chance to interview here. Oh, and like you said, it only took 45 minutes to get here. I couldn't believe it.
That's nice, Ron, but let's get on with our business. As you know, we're looking for an administrative marketing manager. This position reports directly to the vice president of marketing. And reporting to the administrative marketing manager are the 5-person market research staff, a secretary, and administrative assistants.
Let me tell you my work history. My business experiences are full of challenging assignments. As you know, I'm currently working for Chemical Industries Incorporated, and my title is Assistant Marketing Manager. I really think I've outgrown my job. It's not so
much... Your background is important, Ron, but first, let me tell you about Calumet Chemicals to be sure you understand what we have to offer. Then we can explore your education, your work experience.
Well, I'm bored with my job now. After the first 3 months of the job, I had it mastered. These last few years just haven't been very challenging. The VP was out of town a lot, so I made most of the decisions. I had to cover for him a lot.
Yes. Well, right now, I'd like to ask you some questions about your education. Where did you go to?
Oh, I graduated from the University of Iowa and then went to Purdue for my master's. You know, Purdue has a great reputation for chemical engineering. And that school helped make me a mover. I get things done. And even though my title doesn't reflect it, I can do it all, Mr. Watson.
Our time is limited, so let's talk about your work experience. I see you worked for Monaco Corporation. Tell me about your work as regional support coordinator.
What an experience. I spend most of my time traveling around the country working with distributors, introducing what I thought were rather clever promotional campaigns. I enjoyed the work, but it was only a short-term step to bigger and better things.
Who did you report to?
Oh, right to the top, the general manager of the division. They all looked to me to come up with the creative ideas, but I was bored to tears. I think I wasted my talent there. In retrospect, I think I stayed only because I was flattered to be reporting directly to the general manager.
Focus on your accomplishments. What are you proudest of?
Boy, that's a tough question, because I've done it all. I designed a performance review system that was great, really unique. Every time I think about it, I think it was a stroke of genius.
How was it received?
Would you believe by the end of the second year no one was using it? They turned something special into zip. They never understood when they had a good thing.
Ron also didn't understand the relationship between interviewee and interviewer. This wasn't a social conversation. And it was up to him to take the lead from Mr. Watson, not the other way around. Ron didn't seem interested in what Mr. Watson was saying. He was interested only in what he wanted to say. There are many, many conversational clues we miss by not listening well. Listen carefully to this conversation. What's really going on?
I don't know what I'm going to do about my wardrobe. None of these colors seems to match my skin tone now. Even my lipstick doesn't work. Do you see how dark I am?
Oh, I think your clothes are lovely. Well, maybe you should consider stripes to fill you out a bit.
No, it's the colors I'm worried about. My new tan almost seems to clash with them. What colors would go best with this tan? I've never had a tan at this time of year.
So tans come and go. I don't think you should build a wardrobe around how tan you are.
I don't care if I have to go to a tanning salon to keep the tan. I love the way it looks, and I need clothes to complement it. Do you have any ideas or not?
Barbara really wanted Pam to ask her where she got the tan, or tell her how terrific it looked. In fact, she was almost begging for a comment, but she didn't get it and became annoyed. Good listeners almost never miss a conversational clue. Here's another conversation. What's happening here?
I'm home from grocery shopping.
Hi. I'm watching the basketball game. Do you need any help unloading?
No, I can manage. I'll just have to make a lot of trips, I guess. What did you say you're doing?
Watching the game. Are you sure you don't need help?
I can manage if I have to.
Okay.
Jerk.
What happened here? The wife said she didn't need help, but if the husband would have been listening to the sound of her voice and not just her words, he would have heard her asking for help. Of course, he may have gotten her real message, but decided to ignore it anyway, and that's a subject for a different course completely. Have you ever asked someone what was wrong, and the answer was a sullen nothing? But you read the body language, the tone of voice, the pained facial expression, and you persisted until you uncovered the problem. Tune in to the whole person for conversational clues. Listening carefully is very useful and very rewarding. If you're good at it, it tells people you're a thinker, a good conversationalist, and a cultivated person. If you're not particularly good at listening, the person who's speaking may think you don't care about him or her, and thinks that he or she isn't really appreciated. The person who is speaking needs to be acknowledged, needs a confirmation that his or her message got through to you. That's true with a family member, a business colleague, a client, a stranger, anyone we come in contact with. You've got to learn to overcome the roadblocks that get in the way of listening. The first roadblock to good listening is a natural one. It's having more time mentally than you need. And that can lead to daydreaming. I know I've been part of a group conversation where all of a sudden I realized I had no idea what was going on. That can happen because a speaker can talk only so fast, about 100 words or so a minute, and still remain coherent. Most of us, on the other hand, are perfectly capable of listening to 400 or more words a minute, depending, of course, on the complexity of the subject and our backgrounds. So, what happens? Too much time to think about what you're going to say when it's your turn, about the ball game tomorrow night, about the pay raise you think you're going to have to fight for, about the client you have to see. This is natural, but it's a roadblock to effective listening and conversation. And here's another one. Listen.
George. Hey, George. Did you finish the Butler report yet?
What?
The report. Did you finish it yet? I need it to set the budget.
What report?
Geez, will you listen? Where's the Butler report?
Did you ever try to hold a conversation in the wrong place? The phones are ringing, people are talking loudly, the boss drops in, a friend stops by. These situations happen at home and at the office, and they not only get in the way of effective conversation, they can cause friction either through misunderstanding or just frustration. You have to create an atmosphere that minimizes distractions. If you can't get someone to cover your phones during a conversation, go someplace else to talk. If your desk is in an open area, turn it so people can't catch your eye as they pass. Put a sign up that says, "Please don't interrupt until 2 o'clock. Thanks." It may not be easy, but it pays off in better communication and a better job. Another roadblock to effective listening and conversation is knowing, or at least thinking we know, what's going to be said.
Let me tell you, Jack, we're not going to get anything out of this meeting. I mean, the guy who's talking is a vendor, for Pete's sake. He's interested in only one thing, selling his product. I haven't met a salesman yet who gave you the whole story on anything. That shows you the kind of management we have. They bring in this guy to explain our needs.
Instead of trying to extract whatever information we can, we listen too selectively, biased, in fact. And that makes for very poor conversations because we're only trying to get across our own point of view, instead of listening to what's being said around us. We prejudge the speaker without hearing the message. Here's another roadblock.
I had an experience yesterday that you wouldn't believe. I was walking on the sidewalk, you know, in front of that flower shop. Well,
that reminds me, Bill bought me the most beautiful roses this weekend. Wasn't that sweet?
Yeah, what a guy. Anyway, as I was walking, someone came out of the flower shop counting a wad of money.
Oh, you're not going to tell me that's the guy who walked into the telephone pole and the money went flying in all directions?
You're right. I'm not going to tell you anything.
There is nothing worse than a listener who interrupts continually. That's the most obvious way of saying to the speaker that I'm important and you are not. Still another roadblock is emotional listening.
He thinks I'm a little girl. He has to tell me how to do everything. Every time I hit him with a great idea, I get, "This is how we do it here." I don't get any respect, and I don't think management knows how to treat its employees.
If you were having a conversation with Peg when she let loose with this barrage, you'd have to fight the instinct not to continue the conversation like this.
I know what you mean, Peg. They're treating you like a fool. I wouldn't take that kind of guff from my boss.
You might be able to keep the conversation going with that kind of emotional reaction to Peg's emotional outburst, but you wouldn't be doing her any favors. Your goal should be to use questions to help her separate facts from emotions, to help plan a course of action. A final roadblock we create as listeners is simply not being prepared to listen. As you may have learned from that pop quiz I threw at you earlier, where the manager gave instructions on how to conduct a workshop, you may need some work here. Before you start a conversation or listen to a talk or discussion, summarize to yourself whatever you may know about the speaker, the topic, or other listeners to help you focus on what's being said. To be an effective conversationalist, then, you need to be able to remove listener-created roadblocks. 1. Daydreaming. You have more time mentally than you need. 2. Selecting the wrong place to hold a conversation. Too many distractions to concentrate. 3. Listening only to what you know and believe. Tuning yourself out of any meaningful dialogue. Prejudging. 4. Interrupting. It's rude, insensitive, and it also can mean you're jumping to conclusions and prejudging. 5, emotional listening. You can't make effective judgments, recommendations, or conclusions if you let your emotions color your thinking. And 6, not being prepared to listen. Develop an attitude that makes you receptive to new ideas and suggestions. There are 2 sides to the conversational coin. You can set up roadblocks as a listener or as a speaker. For example, have you ever listened to someone who speaks like this? Did it put you to sleep? Well, unless you're really concentrating, you probably didn't get everything you should have from your discussion because you didn't want to work that hard to listen. We all know by now what happens when you don't listen. You miss the message, and you miss the chance to have the kind of conversation you want. Another speaker-created barrier is the use of jargon.
Jennifer tells me you're the fellow who designed that gorgeous catalog we just got in the mail. You must be very talented.
Oh, thanks. Quality lithography can make anything look good.
What's lithography?
Printing. The job ran on the Diddy Glaser half-web.
Oh, well, it is pretty. The pictures are so crisp.
That's because we opted for a 150 line screen and used a 70-pound chrome coat. That's why the whole job is saddle-stitched, by the way. I was afraid the weight of the paper couldn't hold the perfect bind.
Yes, I think Jennifer's calling me. Nice meeting you.
Technical people, meaning people within specific occupations, can be intimidating when they talk down, even without thinking, to non-technical people. That can be their way of saying, I'm more important than you are. Look how smart I am and how dumb you are. Or it could just be a habit formed by years and years of shop talk with their peers. One of the greatest problems we have in our high-tech companies is that management is often non-technical and can fail to grasp the significance of what their engineers or scientists are talking about. Jargon is okay only when it's used by people within a profession or discipline. Otherwise, any attempt at conversation is usually futile. The speaker can also throw out mixed messages.
Come in, Ron. Come in. Nice to see you. Say, great-looking tie. And you're fired.
Well, that's pretty obvious, but speakers can do that, can't they? Do you remember the husband who was watching the basketball game when his wife came in from grocery shopping? She said she didn't want help carrying in the bags, but her voice quality did not match the message. As a speaker, you have to be sure your body language, including the way you say something, even the way you look at someone, matches the message, or you may be misunderstood. Another speaker-created roadblock is a totally disorganized message. The person you're speaking with may jump from topic to topic, may go on too long, may not even give you a clue as to what he or she is talking about. This occurs quite a bit in meetings, and the end result is often inaction. As you'll discover on tape 2, this roadblock can be offset by the judicious use of questions. Don't allow the other party to think he or she got the message across to you when, in fact, you missed it completely. Speaker-created roadblocks, then, include 1, voice quality and delivery. A bad voice, particularly a droning one, can make someone tune out and, in extreme cases, fall asleep. 2, overuse of jargon. Save the shop talk for the people in your department or discipline. Show interest in getting people to understand what you're saying. 3, mixed messages. There's an old song, your lips tell me no, no, but there's yes, yes in your eyes. Don't confuse the issue for the listener. For example, a manager who corrects an employee with a big smile on his face may be interpreted as saying, this really isn't very important, when that's not the message that was intended. And 4, disorganized messages. Think about what you're saying. Let your listener in on the reason behind what you're saying. Otherwise, the result is confusion. This is the point in this course where some people may wonder, despite everything they've heard, why there's so much emphasis on listening in a course on conversation. After all, we want to talk and be heard. But that's not what conversation in its truest form is all about. I've said it before and I'll say it a number of times before you've mastered all the conversational skills. Conversation is a two-way street. and your skills are measured in large part by how well you listen, absorb, and react to what you hear. According to Dr. Tony Alessandra, a top author and lecturer on relationships, in the workplace, we spend about 9% of our time writing, 16% reading, 30% speaking, and 45% listening. The problem is, with all that time devoted to listening, we don't do it well because we're not trained to do it well. Did you learn to listen in school? No, you were taught to read and write. Maybe a few of us had a year or so worth of instruction in speaking, but virtually none of us was taught how to listen. Those people who have either trained themselves to listen well or have taken a course in it have reaped the benefits. Dale Carnegie, in his best-selling book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, described a party he attended. A woman who had heard he traveled extensively asked him to tell about the wonderful places he had visited and the sights he had seen. As they sat down on the sofa, she remarked that she and her husband had just returned from Africa. Mr. Carnegie responded how interesting he thought that was, and that he always wanted to see Africa, the closest he had come being a 24-hour stopover in Algiers. He asked the woman if she had visited big game country, and when she responded in the affirmative, he told her he envied her and asked if she would tell him about Africa. Mr. Carnegie said that the woman proceeded to speak for 45 minutes, never once stopping to ask what he had seen on his travels. All she really wanted was a good listener, so she could have the joy of talking about her once-in-a-lifetime trip. Do you think she told her friends that Dale Carnegie was a fabulous conversationalist? You bet. What Mr. Carnegie probably did was, one, give her his undivided attention, two, make it a point to nod his head from time to time, raise his sounds to indicate interest. And three, he might have also asked for more information from time to time, such as, I find that fascinating, and then what happened? One key to being a good conversationalist, then, is to demonstrate that you really are listening. The tilt of your head, the occasional question or interested sound that tells the speaker you were listening carefully, always gains you points. Now, let's reverse that. You're having a conversation with a group of people, and one of them has asked your position on the new product that's been proposed. As you enthusiastically explain why you're all for it, you notice that everyone is staring at you, but without any expression. Some have their arms folded across their chests. One is sprawled on his chair. Another has her head cupped in her hands, and still another is filing her nails while you're talking. Their body language, even if they're really paying attention, doesn't help you a bit. There's no sound, no acknowledgement of what you're saying. What's going through your mind?
I'm not connecting with them at all. They must think my idea is stupid. Why did I have to open my mouth?
One of the most important things we can do when we're on the listening side of a conversation is to let the speaker know we're there. A nod of the head, a smile, leaning forward to indicate interest, an occasional hmm, or I see, are all ways of saying, I'm with you, let's keep talking. Another way of showing interest and making the conversation work is to ask questions. Now, don't get me wrong. Questions that are used poorly can stop conversations, just as properly timed and phrased questions can enhance conversations. Do you remember Jane's attempt at the quick start on tape one? We're going to come back to it soon, but if you recall, she injected the wrong question at the wrong time. Listen to this use of questions.
Hi, Joe. This must be the hottest day of the year, isn't it?
Yep.
What do you think the temperature is?
90-something.
Do you think this heat wave's going to stop anytime soon?
Nope.
What happened here? Joe may not be much of a conversationalist, or he simply may not have wanted to get into a conversation. But either way, the speaker didn't do much to draw him in. Now let's try it again, taking a totally different tack.
Hi, Joe. I heard you talking to Harry the other day about the greenhouse effect. How does that have an impact on this incredible heat wave?
I didn't know you were interested in anything technical.
When it's this hot for this long, I'd like to know what might be causing it. If you can spare a moment or two, I'd like to know why it's called the greenhouse effect and how it may be creating this blast furnace heat.
Have you ever been in a greenhouse? You know how hot, humid...
It's not too terribly difficult to start a conversation with anyone if you know what his or her hot buttons are, or if you're willing to find them. Everybody wants to talk about their own special interests. Good questions will make them comfortable about doing it. When you respond to a speaker, you're actually drawing him or her into a conversational circle. When you ask questions, you're really clarifying, commenting, and participating in an overall communication. You're giving something back. You're contributing. You're saying, I'm listening and I'm interested. Rudyard Kipling, the famed British author and journalist, had this to say about questions.
I had 6 honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names were what and where and when and why and how and who.
Those are the 6 questions that control conversation. Actually, they go even deeper than that. If you can answer them about any topic, you know a good deal about that topic. And those 6 question words are the basis of any journalism course. Reporters must ask those questions to get at the real answers. There are actually 2 types of questions, closed-end and open-end. Usually, closed-end questions fall into the who, what, when, and where categories.
Who chopped down the cherry tree?
George Washington.
Where can I find the Thompson file?
On Jane's desk.
When do you want to meet?
9 o'clock tomorrow.
What's your favorite sport?
Baseball.
These are all closed-end questions. They're used largely to get information, not to generate discussion. So don't be surprised if you don't get conversation when you use them. On the other hand, if you can construct a how or why question, you've made it difficult for your conversational partner not to give you a conversational answer.
How do you manage to get everything done on time?
Well, it isn't easy. First, I had to get Bob's approval on the proposal, which meant I had to track him down while he was traveling in California. Then,
with all that talent, why do you think the team can't win consistently?
I have a few theories. I think the biggest problem is that they don't have a good shooting guard, so the defense always collapses.
If the questions you ask appeal to the speaker's self-interest, you're almost sure to get feedback. Most people like to talk about themselves. If you encourage them to, you'll get conversation. Plus, how and why questions can't be answered yes or no, at least not easily. Let's listen as Jim tries to strike up a conversation with a neighbor he barely knows. Jim decided to stroll by when he saw the neighbor doing some lawn work. Since the neighbor always seems to be working on the lawn, Jim thought that would be a terrific conversation starter.
Hello! Your lawn looks great.
Thanks.
Wish mine looked like that. Well, be seeing you.
So long.
Jim was trying to be friendly, but the neighbor didn't give him the kinds of responses he had hoped for. Do you think Jim feels this neighbor is quite unfriendly? Probably. But it may be simply that the neighbor isn't much of a conversationalist and has difficulty talking to strangers. Here's how the conversation could have turned out with a bit more appeal to the neighbor's self-interest through the use of questions.
Hello. Your lawn looks great. How in the world do you do it?
Oh, thanks. I just try to stay on top of it.
Well, I try also, but mine doesn't look like yours. Look at the color. What's your secret?
Well, the one thing I do differently from most people is the way I treat it as winter comes on. A little preparation then, and you're months ahead when spring arrives.
Gee, if you're willing to spend a few minutes, I'd love to hear about it. Would you tell me what you do in the winter?
Sure, if you won't be bored to death, I can talk about my lawn forever.
When you listen well, you never run out of questions to ask or invitations to talk. But there's even an art to saying them. Suppose, for example, someone introduces a topic and is waiting for a cue from you to continue. Your response is,
tell me about it.
Remember the roadblocks? If your conversational partner is sensitive to you, he or she heard something that really sounded like, oh no, do I have to listen to this? No matter what the word said. How about this?
Tell me about it. That sounds wonderful.
When you're talking about something, don't be afraid to ask what's going on with your listener.
How do you feel about that?
That's an invitation to your partner to express him or herself, or even a confirmation that you care about what he or she thinks. Recently, a friend of my wife's went to dinner with a business acquaintance of mine. I don't think it was officially called a date, more of a get-to-know-you meeting, but it was certainly a situation that called for good conversation. During the debriefing the next day, my wife asked her friend how she enjoyed the evening and was told she didn't think the fellow was very interested in her. And why not? Because he talked all evening without ever asking her anything about herself. Everything was all about his likes and dislikes, his jobs, his condo, his children, his ex-wife, and his hobbies. He knew how to talk, but he didn't know how to hold a conversation. Since people want to talk about themselves, you can almost always start a conversation with anyone by using your eyes to see what's important to that person, and by using questions to get him or her to talk about that important thing.
Hello, Mr. Kraft. Thanks for seeing me. I notice you have a CPA certificate on the wall. Were you an accountant before you became president?
I'm still an accountant. At least I belong to the National Association. But I don't have much time to practice these days.
What made you decide to leave the profession?
Well, I was asked to help out in marketing in my last company. Asked in the sense that the Army asks for volunteers. And it turns out that I was good at it. After a few years at it, a headhunter called, and here I am. I couldn't say no. And here we are. What can I do for you?
Everyday items can be terrific icebreakers, particularly in cold sales calls. Noticing things that are important to the other person marks you as someone who cares and who is interested in others.
I'm impressed. I haven't seen too many MIT diplomas in my travels. My eyes don't work as well as they used to. What was your degree in?
Electrical engineering.
What did you enjoy most at MIT, other than knowing you were in what many consider the best engineering school in the country?
Notice, not just questions, but a little something added. A compliment never hurts, as long as it doesn't seem insincere. Family pictures, awards, artwork or furniture. There are usually stories behind lapel pins or other emblems that can help start conversations and warm up the atmosphere quickly. Someone once said that to be an interesting person, you have to first be interested. If you develop a sincere, questioning attitude and interest in what others have done, are doing, or plan to do, you've gone a long way in becoming a superior conversationalist. The famous French writer Voltaire said more than two centuries ago that we should judge a man by his questions rather than by his answers. The right question at the right time shows intelligence. Good questions release creative energy in both the person asking the questions and the person responding with answers. And good questions, open-ended questions, are the basis for quick-start conversational openers. On the flip side of this tape is an example of what we call a quick start, a question that can't help but elicit conversation from everyone. But you can also create your own quick starts by using open-ended questions. Here are some examples for you to think about for either social or business encounters.
How do you make a difficult decision? What's the process you use to sort through all the variables?
When you meet someone new, what are your first thoughts?
If you met someone from a different planet, what would you say?
When choosing someone to be a good friend, what characteristics do you look for?
If you scraped someone else's car but no one saw you, would you leave a note?
Technically speaking, some of these questions aren't really open-ended. The last one, for example, can be answered in one word, either yes or no. But there's an obvious follow-up, once you've elicited the information, that can lead to all sorts of discussion concerning ethics, morals, and other conversation-enhancing topics. A quick start is a leading question that will stir conversation and involve everyone. It can be provocative, emotional, and challenging. You started to work with some quick start ideas on the other side of this tape, always phrasing your idea through a question to get maximum response. Do you remember the quick start you heard Jane try to use near the beginning of the first tape? The group was having a discussion about saving money on production costs, and Jane blurted out,
"If there were only four ways to make a living, which would you choose? Would you be an entertainer, a social worker, an administrator, or a scientist?"
This quick start, this surefire conversational stimulant, flopped because Jane didn't understand timing. She didn't listen before she spoke. She didn't understand how to go with the flow and contribute to what the group was talking about, either with words or by attentive and supportive body language. But at the right time, this quick start, or any of the others you'll hear or structure yourself, will keep a conversation moving. This quick start, any quick start used properly for that matter, is based on the fact that most people love to talk. And what they most love to talk about is themselves. It also takes advantage of the fact that each of us is unique in very fundamental ways. You're different from me, as well as from members of your family. You may want different things in life. You might have different beliefs. Incidentally, this quick start and all the others we'll talk about are outlined in your workbook, so don't worry about memorizing it. Just concentrate on how it feels to you. Here's an example of how a conversation might go.
"Honestly, my job can be so frustrating. If it's not one thing, it's another. Sometimes I think I'd like to chuck it all and go live in a cave somewhere."
"Oh, I know the feeling."
"Well, let me ask you two a question, and I'll only tell you why I asked after you answer me. Fair enough? Why do I feel I'm being suckered into something?"
"I'm game. Go ahead."
"Okay, if there were only four ways to make a living, and that's it, which of these four would you choose? Would you be an entertainer, a social worker, an administrator, or a scientist?" Can I have some more options?" "Nope, that's it. These are the only four occupations in the world, and you have to choose one."
"Excuse the interruption, but why don't you play along with this conversation? Which would you choose, being an entertainer, a social worker, an administrator, or a scientist? We'll wait while you think about it."
"Do you have it?"
"Yeah."
"Good. Now, with that in mind, you're coming to work on a Monday morning, and you find a memo on your desk. It says that you have to manage a project. And yes, entertainers can be project managers, just in case that's what one of you selected. For example, you could manage a team that has to put together a musical score for a film, or select site locations, or talent searches. As part of this new assignment, you're given three employees to assist you. You didn't select them, and you don't know them, but you wish that they were certain types of people because you know that would ensure your success on the project. Can I put my current boss on the team?"
"Oh, Jane said you wanted it to be successful."
"I thought, yes, but maybe I could make her life miserable." "Just listen as I describe the four choices you'd have for employee types. One group is very easy to get along with. The people are basically cooperative and optimistic. The second group of people are completely dedicated to their work, and they get satisfaction because they're contributing so much to society through their work. The third group contains solid citizen types, reliable, sensible, stable, and they stick to the rules. And the fourth group can be characterized as having clear thinkers, quite competent and intelligent."
"Let me be sure I understand. I decided what job I wanted, and now I have to pick the kinds of employees I want. Now, I can only choose one of those four groups?"
"Yes. Group A is easy to get along with. Group B finds great societal satisfaction in its work. Group C is reliable and sensible, no surprises. And Group D is the intelligent, clear-thinking team."
While Bill and Sue ponder their answers, you should be aware that this quick start, or really a game, is an open-ended question. It's freewheeling and fun, and it isn't designed to be rigid. Participants in the conversation can go off on any tangent, and there's no pressure to rein them in as you might have to in a structured business discussion. This quick start won't work if you have to force it into a specific conversation, but it will work delightfully well in any social conversation. And that's social, social, or business social. Let's listen to Jane again.
"The answers you've chosen are going to tell us a lot about your preferences in life, how you do your work, and the types of people you like to work with." "Where's your crystal ball, Jane?" I don't need one when I ask questions like these. You give the answers yourself. Tell us about your selection, Sue. Which occupation did you choose? But don't laugh, but I chose administrator.
You're kidding. You always complain about drudge work.
Bill's right, you know. That's the last thing I thought you'd pick if you had free choice. Think about it. I have a great sense of duty, whether it's to my family or my work. And I don't mind working with details. That's true. You always create the schedule for our book club and arrange for all the background reports. And I always take care of the family paperwork and bills, even for my parents. The truth is, I guess I enjoy details because I can usually spin them logically into effective decision-making. I get annoyed with the way some people can't seem to put two and two together.
Yeah, two and two equal five.
Spoken like a real accountant. You know, I really enjoy making decisions because then I'm in control. I know things will be done right. They always are with you. That's why you get picked to head up all those office projects you always complain about.
So what kind of project team did you select?
I bet I know. You think you know me that well? It's not me. The psychology behind the question says that people with certain job preferences have predictable preferences for the types of people they want to work with. Usually people who see themselves as administrators will go for the solid citizen types. Group C. Follow the rules, do what they're told, come in on time, reliable and sensible. I can't believe it. You're right.
Maybe we should call you Sarge. Everything in place, everyone marches to your beat.
Oh, I'm not that bad. Well, now how about you, Bill? What did you pick?
Just what I always wanted to be, an entertainer.
After your performance at the Christmas party, I guess that's not a surprise to anyone.
Now that I think of it, Sue, you organized the party this year, and it was perfect. You are the person who gets picked to do everything. Say, Jane, what do the shrinks say about people who pick entertainer for a profession?
That suggests that you really like to be on the move. You value freedom of action. And what group did you pick to work with?
You tell me. You have all the answers.
The fun group, of course. The ones who get along well with each other.
You've probably picked up the pattern here. There are distinct relationships between occupations and type of people. Now, don't get me wrong. This is pop psychology. Nothing in life is quite this cut and dry. But even making assumptions like this can be fun in a general conversation. The scientist wants intelligent, clear-thinking problem solvers. The entertainer wants an easygoing group. The administrator wants reliability and dependability. And the social worker wants people who get great satisfaction from work he or she feels fulfills a global need. The opportunity for branching out to all sorts of topics is virtually limitless. There are no right or wrong answers, but there may be honest or dishonest answers given as to what an individual may really be feeling. But that's not too important in this setting. However, if you find that you don't want to answer a question with full disclosure, that may tell you a lot more about yourself than what you do answer openly and honestly. More about that later. For now, let's listen to a group of employees sitting around a lunch table. There's not much conversation going on. A half-hearted review of last night's ball game, Marge's child is ill, Bob's father is visiting. And then Jack decides to use one of his favorite quick starts to get everyone's juices flowing.
I just got my expense check. It's the biggest one I ever received.
Your creative writing skills improving, Jack?
It was for that two-week trip to the coast, but it made me think. Just between us, if you could get away with it, would you cheat on your expense report?
How much?
You have a price.
I didn't say that, but let's face it, everybody cheats a little.
Not me.
Have you ever called your wife from the office?
So?
Well, that's a toll call. Where's that benefit listed in your employee agreement? Isn't that kind of picky, Marge? Jack didn't ask us about making 20-cent phone calls. Hold on, Alice. First of all, you've totally dismissed a phone call as not being cheating. We have, what, about 1,000 employees total? Suppose half of them made just a 20-cent toll call each day. That's $100 a day. Spread that over 200 work days a year, and that's an easy $20,000. And I'll bet the number comes closer to $100,000 a year.
What I'm hearing, Marge, is you really wouldn't mind taking 20 cents here and there from the company.
I'm saying that's the reality of any business.
Would you feel the same way if this was a mom-and-pop shop?
About a 20-cent call? You bet.
Okay, let's try it a different way. If you could get away with, say, $1,000 extra on your expenses, and there was no way of catching you, would you take it? Bob?
No.
Alice?
You bet I would. Management here wastes more than that every hour. Let me in on the gravy train.
Suppose this was a mom-and-pop company. Would you still do it?
No. What do you think I am? I wouldn't touch that line with a 10-foot pole.
One little question. Jack's quick start can lead to a conversation that could last hours. It could branch into feelings about the company, about limits and integrity. It could get into white-collar crime versus blue-collar crime. There's no end to where this kind of conversation can go. In their purest form, questions will
elicit opinions,
uncover new information,
lead to problem-solving and decision-making,
develop alternatives,
motivate free expression,
and plant new ideas.
As you'll see when we get to the use of conversation in negotiation, questions can help keep you in control of a discussion, and they can be invaluable in keeping the negotiation on track with no misunderstandings. Used properly, they can initiate conversation, even with a stranger, and help anyone find solutions to the most pressing problems. One last word about questions before moving on to take three. Be careful of the why question. In the wrong hands, it can cause anger, pain, and discontent. Some people use why as a sword, not to gently probe or converse, but to slash and cut.
Why didn't you get that report in on time?
That sounds like a direct challenge to me, and a challenge signals a fight. Aren't you really saying the same thing and getting more to the root of the problem by saying,
how can we be sure we meet future deadlines? What problems are you facing?
Many of us think of negotiating with some sort of negative mindset, as something done by paid mercenaries who have to do this unpleasant activity for a living. But negotiating is an activity, an important activity, that takes place in every aspect of our lives. We negotiate for cars, houses, and other product purchases. We negotiate salary increases, employee responsibilities, even where to take vacations with our families. There's no mystique to negotiating, even though many of us think of some people as being born negotiators. When you really think about it, those so-called born negotiators are simply outstanding conversationalists who know how to listen, question, read body language, and have a terrific sense of timing. How do you prepare for a negotiation? First, you line up as much information as possible about yourself, the other party, and the topic at hand. You make yourself aware of the barriers that get in the way of communication. In the Executive Negotiating Program published by the Thomas Register for its tens of thousands of purchasing agent subscribers, most of whom are negotiators, the point is made that if you're not patient enough to listen, you're going to foul up the negotiation because the other person has something to say and things aren't going to move ahead unless that person gets a chance to say it and be heard. Does this sound familiar? The program advises that you show with your body language that you are listening. Lean forward. Acknowledge something even if you don't agree with it. When you acknowledge something and then restate it, you're promoting clarity and discussion. And something else happens too. When you acknowledge and restate as part of your negotiating conversation, people will give you more information. And that information can be critical in helping you reach your negotiating goals. Listen to this conversation.
Let me be sure I have my facts straight. You're willing to allow us 6 months to prepare the material?
That's the maximum we can spare.
And you want the right to review where we are at the three-month period?
Right.
Now, this is purely speculative, but what do you think would happen if you gave us 7 months to prepare the material?
I can't give you 7 months. That would throw our whole plan out of whack. You'd cost us a lot of money.
Well, what would happen if we complete the job in 4 months?
If it was done properly, it would be a real bonus for everyone concerned.
Am I hearing that we could build in a bonus for early completion?
One of the most valuable ways to demonstrate listening is to use questions to show your interest and to get the other party to respond. And questions, as the example showed, can put you in control of the conversation. Earlier, we talked about emotions as a major roadblock to effective conversations. That's true in general and particularly true in negotiations, when opposing points of view may collide. You actually grow in the estimation of the other party by maintaining your cool. You should always establish your fairness and rationality by saying something like this.
I'm willing to listen carefully to everything you have to say. I'm very interested in your point of view, and I respect your position.
Even if you've set the stage properly, you may be faced with someone who attempts to bully you. No matter what happens, stay calm and continue as if nothing had happened.
That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. I'm wasting my time negotiating with you.
I'm sorry I gave you that impression. Let me try to turn that opinion around with these ideas.
As difficult as it may be at times, do everything in your power to help the other party maintain self-esteem. When you do that, you keep the focus on issues, not personalities. If you don't focus on issues, the other person can become defensive and abusive. You can use your conversational skill to cut off disagreement and stay on track. While we're talking about emotions, there are two red flag words you want to avoid, or at least use very carefully. It doesn't matter if you're in a business or personal negotiation, whether you're negotiating a $1 million deal or talking to your children. We've already talked about the word why. It sounds innocent enough, but it's usually used emotionally.
Well, why not?
Why in the world did you do that?
Why can't you do as you're told?
They sound like fighting words to me. And if you noticed, two of the three examples had the word you in them. And that's the second red flag word. You is often used to make accusations, and nothing can be more damaging to conversations when you're trying to get more information.
You said that we had until March 14th to comply.
You're making this impossible to follow.
You're always late.
Think of how differently this sounds. Instead of saying, you said such and such, try saying, I heard the following, is that correct? What you're doing is letting the individual off the hook by softening your conversational line. You're saying that you'll take the blame for any misstatement, a small price to pay to keep the conversation flowing. Instead of saying, you're making this impossible, try saying, I'm having difficulty understanding how we can get past this point. You're not accusing now. You're saying you see a problem that both of you need to solve. One other thing. When you reach an agreement, be sure to summarize and clarify the terms of the agreement. There's nothing worse than thinking you have agreement, but the person on the other side of the table doesn't quite see it or hear it the way you do. Negotiations are collaborative efforts, and so are meetings. For some reason, however, many meetings tend to be exceptionally dull and overwhelmingly non-productive. Meetings may be the biggest time wasters in your business day, and yet, if the right questions are asked and the right responses made, based on good listening, of course, meetings can be an effective way to move you and your organization forward. What's that you say? You don't always have control of the meetings? So how can your conversation contribute to better ones? Well, there are a number of ways. First, you must plan for the meeting. If the notification to attend is vague or seems pointless, you may want to communicate with the meeting leader to get more information in advance.
Hello?
John, this is Rich Stewart. I received your memo on the new building meeting next week. I'd like to be sure I give you what you want, so I thought I'd ask in advance. I don't really have a say in site or architect selection, so I'm not sure what good I'll do at the meeting.
You manage more people than anybody else in the company, so we're going to need some input on space requirements for the present and future.
How detailed do you want it?
Well, it's just an exploratory meeting, but if you have supportable estimates, That's one less step for the future.
I think we could do a whole course on how to write memos for meetings. The authors of this program say that poor memo writing is one of the leading causes of wasted time. There's no agenda given, no real direction offered, no main topic spelled out, and far too many hidden agendas, which is something we'll deal with on Side B of this tape. The point is, rather than risk wasting your time at a meeting, use your conversational skills to ferret out in advance, one, the purpose for the meeting, and two, your role in the meeting. Once you know what's going on, your second step is to prepare for the meeting. Similar to a negotiation, you owe it to yourself and to everyone else to be as prepared as possible. In this particular case, Rich will put his facts and figures together on personnel and space needs, and possibly prepare handouts to visualize what he'll say. In a formalized group discussion, good presentable handouts or audiovisual materials can be an excellent supplement to your conversation. The third step is the execution phase. Show up at the meeting early. That gives you a chance to do some pre-meeting socializing or lobbying, as the more political elements of your company might call it.
Elaine, nice to see you again. It's feast or famine with us.
How are you? I can't believe we're going to actually get moving on a new building. Don't you think it's about time?
I'm in a situation where I have people doubled up at individual desks. I can't wait to get more space. My problem is that I need only 25% more people, but I'm going to ask for 90% more space. I've been making do for so long. I think the money men don't want to hear how much it can increase productivity if you improve the work environment.
I'm on your side, Rich. First of all, I have a group of studies that demonstrate the impact of environment on the workplace. And second, my staff needs some extra space, too. Let's work together on this one.
As part of the execution phase of meetings, be sure that you participate. You were invited to the meeting and are expected to make a contribution. By contributing, you help the leader, and you can also help the group stick to the agenda. There's a group psychology at every meeting, and enthusiasm is contagious. Let your voice and your body language indicate that you think the session is important, and others will follow along. If some people get emotional or obstinate during the meeting, use your questioning skills to redirect their focus.
I'm sick and tired of all this crying about space and environment. We pay them good money to work, and if they don't like their space, let them get another job.
What I hear you saying is let's not go overboard on the impact of space and work habits. And I don't think anyone can argue with that. But would you agree that two people trying to share a 5-foot space at the same time isn't the best route to productivity?
In a meeting, keep your conversation pertinent to the issue at hand, and don't let yourself be distracted. By making yourself accountable, you'll make the meeting run more smoothly. The last step to having better meetings is the part that many people prefer to avoid, the evaluation phase. Have you ever heard this conversation after a meeting?
What a stinker. I can't believe I just spent 2 hours of my life in that room. Nothing ever gets done. Nobody cares. What a waste of time.
When you're not the person running the meeting, you may feel uncomfortable about offering constructive observations. But you're really being dishonest to yourself, and to everybody else for that matter, when you take the easy way out and complain to yourself or a colleague, and then repeat the same process again and again. Use your conversational skills to make comments to the leader about the meeting structure and outcome. That doesn't mean you have to focus on the negative. If good things happen, praise them. And when you can identify ways to improve group performance, share them.
Bill, that was terrific. I think that's the most we've ever accomplished in that short a period of time. There were so many ideas. I wonder how much is going to stick. What would you think of having a secretary sit in or designating someone to take good notes so we don't run the risk of having some of these great ideas go up in smoke? That way we have an on-the-record follow-up system as well.
Another thing happens with well-phrased questions. You allow your conversational partner to take part in the decision-making process. Instead of saying, you should do this or that, you're asking, what do you think of this idea? Nearly everyone appreciates being asked. What are some of the other problems you can face in a meeting? You may have Mr. or Mrs. Know-It-All, who's bound and determined to dominate the conversation. You have to try to work around this person's ego and get others involved before they tune out.
And I want to take the ball and run with it because everything I've done with my team makes this seem unnatural. As I've said...
Al, excuse the interruption, but we're really pressed for time. We need to hear from Dick and Suzanne. If there's time, we can come back to you. Thanks for your thoughts. Dick, your thoughts, please.
One thing you can do to make sure you're reaching the group is to be a keen observer of body language. If you're presenting your views and you notice others drumming their fingers, doodling, shifting excessively in their seats, or looking everywhere but at you, you know you're not having the positive impact you want. Oh, don't confuse this, by the way, with lack of expression on someone's face. That may be a person who strongly controls his or her emotions. You need to concentrate on what's wrong, and the twitchers are telling you that something is. Negotiations and meetings take up much of our time. To make them pay off for you, you should... 1. Observe others' body language to see if you're getting through to them. 2. Use body language to show that you're listening. 3. Use questions to get information and to take control. 4. Always keep your emotions in check. 5. Be careful of the words why and you. They sound like attacks to many people. 6. Plan, prepare, execute, and evaluate to make meetings meet your needs. And 7. Always clarify and summarize at the end of a negotiation or meeting to be sure that what you heard is what the other party said, and vice versa. All the conversational skills are intertwined. For example, if you wanted to discuss growth or salary with your boss, what are you actually doing? 1. You're in a negotiation, whether you want to call it that or not. 2. You want to use your persuasive skills to get him or her to see your side of the issue. And 3. You want to motivate your boss to get you what you feel you deserve. So all in one, you're a negotiator, a salesperson, and a master motivator. Unfortunately, most people don't realize that and leave their conversational skills behind when they have that dreaded annual talk. One reason they do that is because they don't prepare for this event as they would for a more formal negotiation or meeting. And preparation and planning are the keys to getting your conversational act together. In the case we're about to hear, Bob, a middle manager, wants a formal performance evaluation each year, as he was originally promised by the personnel department when he was hired 3 years ago. Every year his salary has increased 5% without explanation or reason. He's not terribly happy about that, because he's heard through the grapevine that others have received as much as a 10% increase. He doesn't know his boss particularly well. She's had the position for a little over a year. He knows only that she has an MBA, is on the company's fast track, and runs a tight ship within budget.
I've got to plant the thought that this is as important to her as it is to me. I have to appeal to her self-interest.
Yes, Bob, what can I do for you? I can only spare about 10 or 15 minutes.
Marge, but this talk is important to both of us, particularly with the new project staring us right in the face.
Is something wrong?
Spell it out clearly. No, nothing's wrong. I'm pleased with the company and with my work, but before I take on a new challenge, I need to understand my role and my future here.
I didn't think you needed constant stroking, Bob. Can't we do this some other time? There's no problem with your work.
Stay confident. Assert yourself. We can probably finish this some other time, but I've been waiting 3 years for the performance appraisal I was promised.
When did I ever promise you a performance appraisal?
You didn't, but that was a condition of employment. Personnel told me that would be the basis of my growth here. Don't attack. Don't be emotional. Respect her position, or you'll be in a war. Look, I'm as much at fault as anyone. When you were brought in as head of the department, I always tried to respect your time, and I never bothered you about the appraisal. But I don't know where I stand, and it's really starting to bother me.
Well, this is news to me. I didn't know you were promised a formal performance appraisal, and I'm surprised you didn't know where you stood. From time to time, I always tried to tell you you were doing a good job, and I'll be happy to reiterate that.
Don't take it personally. Most managers avoid performance appraisals whenever they can get away with it. I've let her off the hook for over a year, so don't blame her for being human.
Look, Bob, you're a good person, you do good work, and you're appreciated.
Thanks. But what can I be doing to improve my chances around here? My future's important to me, and so is money. I'm perfectly aware that some people have gotten larger raises than I got, and I'm interested in knowing how the various percentages are determined.
You're doing good work, but you're not doing anything special. The top range acknowledges something special, and frankly, I never thought you were particularly motivated by money.
That's what I get for not speaking up. I'll never make that mistake again.
Also, Bob, a lot of people around here have MBAs, and we tend to pay them more.
There's a piece of information I needed confirmed. That's another reason we need to have a more formal discussion on a regular basis, Marge. Number one, I'm enrolling to obtain an MBA. And number two, I brought 10 years of experience with me when I joined this organization. And I think that's worth quite a bit, too.
I had no idea you were going after a master's. I'm not sure I can do anything for you on the regular pay increase at this point, but I might be able to do a lot for you in covering the cost of the MBA program. But we'll have to discuss our alternatives some other time. I have to leave for a meeting now.
Don't let her off the hook, but make it easy for her to give the formal assessment I want. I know you're pressed for time, so let me do this. I'll write my own appraisal. I'll tell you in writing what I feel are my strengths and weaknesses, and then you can react to it instead of having to spend hours compiling it. I'll have it on your desk next Monday, and if it fits your schedule, I'd like to meet with you to review it the following Monday. Is one time more convenient for you than another?
Here are some questions for you to consider. Did Bob profile his audience of one? Did he try to appeal to Marge's self-interests? How? He did not respond to her cutting comment about his not doing anything special. Should he have? Bob didn't use a lot of questions in this conversation. Of course, it's obvious that his speaking partner had no problem giving feedback. But are there any areas where questions may have helped him get more information, either for this meeting or prior to the next one? One of the first things you do prior to a conversation with anyone or any group you don't know particularly well is to mentally profile that person or persons. It's a lot easier to motivate or persuade someone if you can tailor your conversation to suit that person's special interests. Even if the individual is a total stranger, or more correctly, especially if that person is a total stranger, you should go through this exercise to prepare you for your conversation. I'll run through this list for a business conversation, but you should have no trouble converting it to a social situation. As I list these items, think if Bob related to Marge as well as he should have. 1. What's the role of your conversational partner in the organization? How far does his or her influence extend? 2. What is his or her relationship to you? 3. Is he or she a forceful person or laid back? 4. Does he or she relate to a cheerful, dynamic approach or a more somber, relevant approach? 5. Are you on a technical level with this person? Do you need to limit the use of jargon? 6. What can you do for this person? And 7. What do you want to happen as a result of this conversation? About the only thing I saw that Bob did wrong in his conversation was to whine a bit in the beginning. He complained that he had been waiting for years for a performance appraisal, and Marge, who would seem to have a low tolerance for complaints or challenges, was ready to bite his head off for it. But he quickly caught himself and righted the conversation. Specifically, Bob appealed to her interests with his enrollment in an MBA program, which was obviously important to her. He also appealed to her interests by offering to create the performance appraisal himself and save her time. Early in the conversation, Marge could have construed Bob's reference to needing to understand his role before taking on new challenges as a threat, but his earnest tone of voice largely negated that. Bob probably did the right thing by letting Marge's somewhat nasty comment, "You haven't done anything special," go, particularly since there will be a follow-up meeting, and he'll have plenty of time to prepare a list of all the things he did that he considered special. Because of Marge's low annoyance threshold, he was justified in letting it go. Finally, Bob might have asked a few questions, not necessarily to keep the conversation alive, but to get more information. He could have asked Marge what the company's MBA policy was intended to accomplish, or how it's been proven that such a policy benefits the company. Did Bob do a good job selling himself? By engaging in a conversation and holding his own, he opened his boss's eyes to his value. Bob understood that the key to motivating or persuading someone is to communicate to the other person's point of view. All the persuasion and motivational techniques in the world won't work if the other person won't listen to you. Not everybody responds to the same message the same way. For example, I know two families who live next door to each other and who seem exceptionally similar in many ways. One went to an auto dealership, purchased a car on the spot, and raved about the salesperson and the price they received. Based on their recommendation, the second family went to the same dealership, had the same salesperson, and were so turned off by the high-pressure tactics, they vowed never to walk into that dealership again. How could that happen? How could one person's satisfaction be the other's utter dissatisfaction? Different people react in different ways. That's the message you should get from this. Not every technique works the same way on everybody. Once again, take the time to size up the other party, and you'll develop a terrific success record in getting others to do what you want. Another way of saying the same thing is that all the persuasion and motivation techniques in the world are worthless if the other person isn't listening to you. That means you have to create an environment for people to listen. Think how motivated you were when someone, a supervisor, spouse, friend, or colleague, communicated a message to you that he or she wasn't listening.
I never knew if my boss was paying attention to me. He'd tell me to talk, and then he'd keep on going over whatever was on his desk in front of him. It made me feel as if what I did wasn't very important to him or the company.
I had a supervisor who never let me finish a sentence. The jerk interrupted everything, and he wasn't even nice about it. I tuned him out and did whatever I wanted.
I took a lot of time explaining to my neighbor how to use my brand new power saw that he wanted to borrow. Right in the middle of it, he started talking about the softball game he was playing tomorrow. Wait till he asked me for help again.
If, for example, you want to motivate an employee to do a better job, don't do it with harsh criticism. According to most experts, you'll find it far better to praise people for behaving as you want them to than to punish them for behaving in a way you consider inappropriate. That works equally well for friends, employees, children, just about anyone you can think of. Everyone has a different hot button. It could be recognition, money, peer approval, acceptance, security, pride. You motivate people by tapping into their feelings and interests. And how do you do that? You know the answer by now. You listen and use questions to get information about what the other person wants. To move people, to motivate them to your point of view, you have to deliver a message that's personally satisfying to each and every one of them. However, don't fall into the trap of simply saying whatever you think they want to hear. There's nothing worse than insincerity. Once you're caught faking it, you'll never get your credibility back. But you can offer benefits that will appeal to them. You may be able to motivate your listeners to feel that they will be better people if they listen to your message. You may appeal to their sense of altruism or their desire to help others. They may be susceptible to their sense of pride and duty that others are counting on them. Discover their interests and appeal to them. salespeople will often use leading questions to motivate potential buyers.
Would you like to increase profits without spending another penny?
Do you want to save money on the cost of heating or cooling your home?
Will you switch brands if I can prove to you you'll get more for your money?
Salespeople know that by offering an immediate benefit, they'll reach their first critical step in motivating or persuading their client to do something. Get them to pay attention. Then they use their questioning and conversation skills to continually involve the individual or group in their message. When you're trying to motivate or persuade someone, you must demonstrate that you care about them. And you can do that by remarking on things that they do well, wear well, or say well.
You did such a great job on meeting the deadline.
I'm impressed with your grasp of the subject.
Boy, do you have a knack with children.
Avoid criticism and focus on positives. Listen attentively and make eye contact. Pay attention to his or her body language to be sure that your message stays on target and that you hold the other person's interest. Don Sheehan, who was one of the greats on the sales motivation lecture circuit, talked about sincerity as one of the greatest gifts of persuasion. "Don't we all trust people who we know want to help us?" was his constant reminder about sales success. He could have been talking about motivating or persuading someone to buy a product, an idea, an opportunity, or a salary increase when he said, "True selling is not putting something over on someone. It's not stuffing something down his throat. No, I equate selling with friendship." You've reached that point in the course where you're ready to tackle the final challenge. With Tape 4, you'll develop a system for confidently handling difficult conversations. You'll become the master communicator you've always wanted to be. You know that questions can keep a conversation moving forward, as well as uncovering hard-to-get-at information, setting the stage for problem-solving and new directions. Good questioning techniques can put you in charge at meetings, social gatherings, one-on-one conversations, and presentations before large numbers of people. Peter Drucker, the well-known management consultant and author, says, "The right answers are the result of asking the right questions." That's more or less a modern-day version of a bit of ancient Greek wisdom. Socrates said about 2,000 years ago that a question well asked is half the answer. You've learned how to read body language and other nonverbal signals. You know that active listening skills will make you a better conversationalist, yes, even without saying a word. You've learned some secrets about motivation and persuasion, and how you can use all these skills to negotiate a better deal for everything from a car to a million-dollar business deal. And it only seems like a car costs $1 million today. And finally, you've had the opportunity to listen to some author-constructed quick starts. And more important, you've learned how to construct your own, having a never-ending arsenal of interesting thoughts and topics you can use at any gathering. There is one last skill you need to master. It's a six-step process that underlies all communication. It's the final step in connecting with other people. Think about this sentence.
When in the presence of another person, you cannot not communicate.
That's a little bit awkward, but the thought is accurate. When you're with another person, you're always saying something, even if you think you're not.
How do you like this crazy weather?
Even the weather people don't know what's going on.
I guess we're kind of lucky today. A few degrees colder and this rain would have been about a foot of snow.
Yeah, that's all we need.
Wonder how bad the acid rain content is.
Who knows?
How do you feel about the problem?
Not much.
What is happening in this situation is that the woman is really disinterested in the turn of the conversation and felt she could cut off the communication by saying nothing. But the silence that followed her remarks is filled with all sorts of thinking time.
What a diss. Once you get past the weather, she's got nothing to say.
Why does he always wait till I'm busy? Doesn't he have any work to do?
The point is that silence doesn't put a conversation on hold. In fact, the conversation continues internally, generating thoughts that may be quite negative. You may not have a clue as to what those thoughts are. No, the tape isn't defective. You just heard 5 seconds of silence. But I bet your mind didn't go blank with the tape. You were wondering if the tape was damaged or your player broken. You were wondering if you missed something. Perhaps you rewound the tape or fast-forwarded it. Whatever you did, you didn't stop thinking. And that's why it's important, even though you've mastered many conversational skills already, that you learn this final set of skills. You need to be able to understand what's really going on with your conversational partner. You need to be able to connect at a higher level to get everything you want from your conversational opportunities.
Jim, excuse me, but there's been a change in policy on when the employees can use the main parking lot. And I'd appreciate it if you'd distribute this memo.
Oh, hi, Ann. Glad you stopped by. Take a look at these pictures of my ski trip. Look at Bob in his ski suit, will you? Looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy. I'll tell you...
Well, that's nice, but if you'll put them aside, we have to move.
There's no silence here, but there's still a classic miscommunication. Ann needs to get out a corporate policy memo, and Jim's still on a high from his winter vacation. In a sense, they see each other, but they're really talking past each other. They're not connecting. All of us have been on either end of this sort of miscommunication. And the reason is that we weren't aware of or weren't paying attention to the 6-step process that forms the basis for any meaningful conversation. The emphasis here is on the word meaningful. Relationships are made or broken through the things we say to each other. While we may be able to converse perfectly well at one level, we still run the risk of being misinterpreted or misunderstood. That's because many people will engage in a conversation without fully understanding their own position in relation to the person with whom they're speaking. The 6 steps that follow are your keys not just to becoming an outstanding conversationalist. They're your keys to improving communication and relationships at work, at play, and at home. Step 1 is identifying the subject of the conversation. What is the real issue, problem, or circumstance? In plain language, be sure you're both talking about the same thing. Step 2 is agreeing on the history behind the subject. What happened? Step 3 is agreeing on what the facts are, which often is not as simple as it sounds. One of the biggest mistakes people make in conversation is to confuse the facts of a situation with their own feelings and opinions. Step 4 is interpreting the history and facts. Why and how did it happen? Step 5 is identifying your emotional reaction. Here's where you can sort through your feelings and opinions based on the subject, the history, and the facts. And step 6 is determining a course of action. Once you and your partner have agreed on the subject, history, and facts, and you've both expressed your feelings and opinions, you then create an action plan. What do you need to do as a result of this conversation? What steps do you want to take? Some of us are very effective at parts of this 6-step process. We may be good, for example, at identifying and verbalizing emotions, but not very good at all in deciding what to do about them. Some of us are very good at creating action plans, but we don't bother getting the facts first, creating all sorts of problems for ourselves and others. But by formally or informally using this proven system, you can develop a method for avoiding miscommunication and improving relationships. Follow along with this practice exercise that will help you put this process together. We're going to start developing this skill by listening to a manager describe a current concern of his. Listen for the facts.
I'm a manager in a large office supply company, and Barbara has worked for me for the last 2 years, and she's been with the company nearly 18 years. About a year ago, a totally new purchasing system was installed, and it was designed to be used on a personal computer. The problem is that Barbara can't quite seem to get the hang of it. even though she received extensive training on the system and the software, and she has a performance review due in about 2 weeks. Proper use of the system is a written job responsibility, specifically spelling this out as one of Barbara's performance objectives. She and I are the only two people who have anything to say about her performance. Also, her monthly summaries of purchases have been 1 to 2 weeks late for virtually every month that the system's been in place, and top management is very unhappy with the timing and the inaccuracies.
Let's review what we heard the manager say. He clearly identified 4 bits of information that are documented. There's no debate as to whether they happened or not. They are facts. The manager has stated that, 1, Barbara has not produced accurate and timely reports that are, 2, a basic part of her written job responsibility. 3, she was trained to do the job. And 4, he has been warned by management that they will not accept any more inaccurate reports. So far, the manager has followed steps 1, 2, and 3. He has identified the issue that will have to be discussed. He has a grasp of the history behind the issue, and he's plotted or mapped the facts that you just heard. His next step is to interpret the history and facts. But before we go to that next step, let's take a step back ourselves and review why the manager is going through this process. Every day, our senses gather information about many situations. And just as our desks pile up with paper, our minds stack bits of information in our memories. In a week's time, you may have collected all sorts of data about 100 or more events. And then a month or so later, you want to have a serious conversation about some of that information you collected. Well, it's only fair to you and whoever might be involved in a conversation with you that you've accurately separated fact from fiction, opinions from beliefs, and attitudes from events. If you don't do that, your mind can get a little confused, and your story might just reflect an odd mixture of facts, emotions, and opinions. And you know the result, an argument or an unwillingness to communicate. Back to the manager, who's about to move to step 4, interpreting the facts he's mapped, to get as clear an idea as possible on where this issue is headed. What interpretations have you made based on his relationship with Barbara? Here are his interpretations of the facts.
I can't give Barbara a raise. If this continues, my job may be on the line. Barbara's lazy. I can't count on her performance anymore. She's not interested in her job.
Now, the manager hasn't arrived at any conclusions or solutions yet. He's still linking the various steps, which may be the most difficult part of this whole process, because we all have a natural tendency to jump from the facts to a solution, and that's dangerous. Listen to this conversation and think about what's wrong with it.
Did you hear about the robbery in accounting?
What?
Yep. It seems the cleaning crew broke into the petty cash box last night and cleaned that out along with the floors.
How do you know it was them?
I've been saying all along that security needed to keep a closer eye on them. Look, accounting's always gone by 5:30, and that's the first office the cleaning crew does. When Joan came in this morning, she found a rusty screwdriver on the floor and the petty cash drawer pried open. The box was smashed in. I figure one of the cleaning crew found that screwdriver while he was cleaning up and just couldn't resist the temptation.
Typical, huh? A quick jump from a few facts to an assumption or inference. That's exactly what you have to be able to analyze to become an effective communicator. Part of becoming a great communicator is definitely an art. That's the part where you choose the words, lower or raise your voice, smile, demonstrate body language, exhibit enthusiasm, and countless other touches you've learned as you went through this course. But the skill is the part where you analyze and structure, where you organize the parts into a system that helps you get the results you want. Before we move to step 5 and identifying emotional reactions, some background. Although things are starting to change somewhat, our culture has basically presented men as not having feelings, or of sublimating them consciously or unconsciously. Yet feelings are a major part of communicating. Not that they have to be expressed in every situation, but it's important that a good communicator be in touch with what they are. Feelings are spontaneous reactions to an event. They just happen, and they're psychological pointers that can help direct you to the most effective action to take in any situation. Feelings are your basic resource for understanding what you expect, what you're thinking, and what you want.
Feelings, feelings, feelings. Look, many of our feelings aren't pleasant, and I don't care if you're a man or a woman. You've got to shove them aside to get on with your life.
That's a natural reaction. And before I answer that directly, let me ask you to do something. Think back to when you expected a certain behavior from someone, and that person broke your expectation.
That's easy. I was supposed to have lunch with an important client last week, and he stood me up. I drove 32 miles to a restaurant, and he never showed up.
And how did that make you feel?
Angry and confused. Did he do it intentionally, or did he just forget? Either way, it was pretty obvious I didn't mean a whole lot to him.
You followed a natural human process. First, there was an event. You went to lunch, and your partner never arrived. Then you had an interpretation of the event. He doesn't like me or my product. And you had a feeling or two. You were angry and confused. Now, let's go back to our manager and Barbara. You've heard and read what's transpired so far. What do you think his feelings are?
If I were in his shoes, I'd be angry at Barbara, or maybe disappointed is a better word. How could she foul up like that when she's done such a good job for so long? Or maybe I'd just be sad that 18 years seemed to be going down the drain, and I'd feel bad for her as a person.
A moment ago I said that feelings are pointers for what will happen. If the manager was angry, as you first suggested, what do you think might happen?
Well, there might be a really ugly confrontation.
Suppose he was disappointed.
The action might be softer. His approach might be, Barbara, I don't understand why your performance isn't up to par.
And sadness?
That might be, poor Barbara, she just can't hack it anymore. What am I going to do with her?
Thanks for your help. You've made the point that feelings will help drive an action. They make you react to others the way you do. In effective conversations, it's not necessary to splash our feelings over other people. But it's important that we know just what our feelings are and how we're using or showing those feelings. What we want to do here is intelligently apply everything we've done so far to an action plan. And we'll start to do that with four words. One is need. The second is want. And the third and fourth words are would like. The word need means a necessity. We need money, housing, food, health, shelter, and protection. The word want means a desire. We may want a larger car or to be president of the firm or an ice cream sundae. Even though those two words are synonymous in the dictionary, they really have two separate meanings for our purposes. For example, you may want to be president of your company. Would you act differently, make the same kinds of decisions, than if you decided that you needed to be president? Need implies a must-happen action, while want implies an I'm-working-toward-it action. The phrase would like is more general than want. It's somewhat of a creative area in your thinking. I would like to be president leads to a totally different action plan than I want to or need to be president. Would like means I'm going to file this away for future evaluation or use. Suppose you were Barbara's manager. What need statements would you make? What want statements would you use? Going back to Barbara and her manager, what does the manager need?
I need Barbara to agree on a contract between us to change her behavior and attitude.
What does he want?
I want Barbara to accept criticism, to be productive again, and to rebuild our working relationship before one of us is fired.
The word want describes intentions. What do you want to happen as a result of your action plan? Finally, what would the manager like to happen?
I'd like things to be the way they were. We understood each other and trusted each other.
The manager has worked through five steps. He has carefully and honestly defined the concern, listed the facts, identified his feelings, and separated his wants from his needs, from his would likes. Having taken these steps, the action plan becomes a rather straightforward process. The objective of the action plan is to formulate a performance contract with Barbara to adequately perform her job responsibilities. The steps to implement this action plan include, 1, a meeting with Barbara to present the analysis of her performance. 2, have Barbara make her own analysis of the issue. 3, compare Barbara's facts, thinking, and feelings to his own. 4, if Barbara's analysis differs to any great degree from his own, he'll request that she and he enter a written contract to complete specific objectives, such as a complete training program, and an understanding that if agreed-upon goals are not met, termination may result. The manager's complete action plan may be found near the end of Book 2. One of the most misunderstood parts of this six-part process of developing accurate and meaningful conversation and communication is the role of feelings. Thinking is an objective process, and feelings are subjective. In organizations, especially ones that are highly structured and task-oriented, thinking is usually valued over feelings. What happens, though, is that a person or group functioning in this very organized setting and placing a strong emphasis on thinking runs a giant risk of making poor decisions because one of the most important elements in communication has been omitted.
What? Is this a sensitivity course? What do feelings have to do with effective decision-making and hard-nosed business decisions? Maybe they're okay for relationships, but certainly not for business.
That's a fairly typical reaction. But what happens is that feelings may be guiding your decisions. And if you're not aware of your feelings or won't admit to them, you may not be making the best decisions, like it or not. Think about a decision you made recently that involved a concern you had with another person. How did you come to your decision? Was it based solely on thinking? Were you aware of your feelings when you made the decision? This isn't an easy question, so follow along with a few examples. Do you remember the fellow who was sure the cleaning crew stole the petty cash from the accounting office? Remember, he theorized that they found a rusty screwdriver and couldn't resist temptation. He was totally in touch with his feelings. I think it's safe to say that he felt disgust for the cleaning crew and some happiness about being right about the potential problem with security. What's wrong, however, is that his feelings were based on opinion, not fact. That led to a misleading conversation, which falls into the category of gossip, rumor, and innuendo. That misleading conversation could then have led to an action decision such as firing the crew. The point is that when you're feeling something, be sure to check the facts prior to acting on those feelings. Another example, a manufacturer's representative, who we'll call Harry, told me that he had an inquiry from a client about a potentially large order. He called Matt, the sales manager of the manufacturer he represented, 4 times that day, trying to get prices for his client. Each time he was told that Matt would get back to him as soon as possible. By the 4th call, Harry was enraged and sent a fax hoping it would get Matt's or anyone's attention at the manufacturer's. By 6 o'clock, he left, feeling quite hostile. He was going to call in the morning and let Matt or his boss really have it. In the morning, Harry found a message on his answering machine that sounded like this.
Hi, Harry. This is Matt. I'm sorry I couldn't get back to you yesterday. I was held hostage in a national sales meeting all day. It's 6:40 at night, and this is my first time up for air. I'll get to you first thing in the morning.
Everything went fine in the morning, but Harry admitted that he had come close to causing a scene for all the wrong reasons. It really had nothing to do with Matt's not getting back to him as quickly as he had hoped. He hadn't made any sales for them in a long time. He was embarrassed and defensive about it and was sure they weren't returning his calls because they were giving him a message. His feelings were based on opinion, not fact. Many people have difficulty identifying thoughts from feelings. Listen to these statements and choose the ones that are feelings statements.
I feel we should break for lunch.
I'm proud of my report.
I'm relieved to hear you're better.
I feel our relationship is good.
I'm uneasy about your decision.
The feeling statements are, I'm proud, I'm relieved, I'm uneasy. The other two statements are thinking statements. You can substitute the word think for feel in both of them.
I think we should break for lunch.
I think our relationship is good.
A feeling should be expressed directly. I'm happy or I'm disappointed. There's no need to say I feel happy, since happy is a feeling. In fact, if someone says he or she feels happy or sad, it becomes a thought rather than a feeling. Listen carefully during a conversation and see if anyone uses the word feel. Determine if he or she is expressing a thought or a feeling. Feelings are terrific devices for measuring your reaction to something. The manufacturer's rep admitted that his feelings of anger were misplaced. He was angry at himself, and he needed to do something about it. If you use all parts of the six-step system for effective conversation, you'll shorten the psychological gap between you and the other party. When you're aware of your feelings and you understand them, you can dramatically reduce differences between yourself and your conversational partner. This six-step system is a key to open, sincere conversations. While it's not an absolute necessity when you're making small talk, it can be very helpful for larger occasions, such as dealing with problem employees, negotiating a raise, disciplining a child, or building a relationship. Do you remember Bob's salary negotiation with Marge? He was always in touch with his emotions and facts, and he used the conversation to get more facts. Bob did one other thing. He pressed for a commitment with his boss. He didn't just work through the facts, the history, emotions, and action plan on his own. That's good for sorting everything out, but it's not going to do you much good if you don't share it with someone else in the form of a conversation. Bob gained credibility in his boss's eyes because he communicated well. Credibility is the critical element in leadership and in building productive relationships. One last thought I'd like to leave with you is the gift of enthusiasm. We've made the point before that it's not necessarily what you say, it's how you say it. And nothing works more to persuade and motivate others than to communicate with them enthusiastically. Here is a lesson that Nate Rosenblatt, one of the course co-authors, learned early in his career.
I had an assignment to create a full-page ad for a national department store chain. Now, this was pretty hot stuff for a 22-year-old just breaking into advertising. I labored over the copy and artwork, putting in 16-hour days until I had what I thought was the perfect ad. With a great sense of excitement and anticipation, I walked into my boss's office with the finished layout. I was taping it to his wall when he asked me what I thought of it. Well, trying to be very nonchalant, I said, I think it's okay. What do you think? He said, what don't you like about it? Before I could answer, he gave me a lecture on enthusiasm. If you like what you did, he said, tell me about it. Get me excited. Stride into my office with confidence and poise and say, Don, look at this. Is this going to bring in traffic or what? I think I've created an ad that's going to move lots of suits. Tell me that this isn't going to be a hit. The message my boss gave me was that if you have something to sell, a product, an idea, a state of mind, you're not going to be very successful if you don't show your enthusiasm first. Enthusiasm is catching, he said. And when people see that you believe in yourself, they believe in you too.
There is a magic to enthusiasm, a positive feeling that will help you master the art and skill of conversation. If you continue to practice the skills you've heard in this course, you'll become a more successful, confident, and relaxed communicator. You'll get your ideas across effectively, and you'll get the results you want. I know that you've profited from this course, and speaking for the authors, I wish you all the good things you're about to earn with your new conversational skills.
Copyright 1995, Dove Audio Incorporated.